brought to you by ConcordiaTheology.org, bringing you resources that support the vigorous life of the mind in service of the gospel of Christ.
Welcome to Tangible, Theology Learned and Lived. We're exploring the ways in which theology permeates all aspects of life through conversations with the faculty here at Concordia Seminary St. Louis. We will challenge you to deepen your theology and live out your faith in Christ. I'm your producer and host, Jessica Bordolo. I'll talk with a variety of professors on a variety of topics, something different every episode, but all pointing to the intersection between faith and daily life, when it's tangible, theology learned and lived. And today we're talking about artificial intelligence and the theological questions that go with it. Our guests are Dr. David Maxwell and Dr. Joel Okamoto. They're both professors of systematic theology here at Concordia Seminary St. Louis. But not only do these guys know their theology, they have experience working with digital technology. And I want to hear about that first. Dr. Maxwell, tell me about the computer program you've been working on.
Well, computer programming as a hobby and trying to explore the Java sound system. And I'm actually using ChatGPT to help me learn it, sort of as a tutor. But I think probably the program you're thinking about is about 4 years ago, I actually watched a series of YouTube videos about how to make a neural network on your own home computer. And I followed the instructions and made the neural network, and it actually worked. So there's a post on ConcordiaTheology.org about that.
Nice. Dr. Okamoto, what kind of experience have you had with computer systems?
I am interested in matters of technology. Especially as they relate to what it means to be human. Everybody uses technology. It's something basic to being human. And artificial intelligence is an example of what we've been doing with that, and one with a lot of implications. So I'm interested from that perspective.
And that's where I'd like to start. Dr. Maxwell, you recently wrote an article titled Artificial Intelligence, Astonishing Progress That Raises Theological Questions. Our listeners can find that on ConcordiaTheology.org. But let's start with that basic. Dr. Maxwell, what is AI?
Well, it's based off what's called a neural network, which is a kind of way of modeling a brain, really. It's not really like a computer program that we're used to. But instead, the computer inside its memory represents a whole bunch of different neurons that are connected to each other in very complex ways. And if you have like a billion of them, you start getting some really interesting results, which is what we've been seeing with ChatGPT and also GPT-4 and the other forms of artificial intelligence that are out there too. Facial recognition, things like that. It's not that hard. I mean, you can do it at home. And this is one of the things that I find astonishing about AI is that the basic concept is not that complicated, and yet the results you get are extremely complicated these neural networks now that are able to, like GPT-4 is able to analyze human emotions pretty well. It's able to do all kinds of things that look pretty human.
I know there have been conversations on campus among faculty about how ChatGPT might influence students' work and how that might be good or bad. Dr. Okamoto, have you had any experience with students using ChatGPT in class?
I know somebody used it to do an assignment. This is afterward. And it did a good job. It took him like three times as long as if he just sat down and wrote it. But it did show, actually, it was very interesting. It showed the student knew what kinds of questions to ask, prompts to make, in order to get the right answer, which actually that's a good assignment. But that gets you into things about the nature of our assignments. If a machine can do it, maybe it's not what we should be asking for. That's a question about the nature of intelligence itself.
Dr. Maxwell, you referenced a recent Microsoft paper in your blog, and it was Sparks of Artificial General Intelligence, Early Experiments with GPT-4. And that article describes the capabilities and limitations of GPT-4. But in general, what are some of the limitations?
So artificial general intelligence refers to the ability to learn stuff that you're not taught. So in other words, there are certain AIs that are very good at task, like the one I did. It can recognize digits written from 0 to 9, written by human beings, but that's all it can do, right? Or other kinds of AI can do facial recognition, but that's all it can do. ChatGPT can predict like what word comes next in a sentence, but that's perhaps all it can do. General intelligence means the AI could actually become competent in other domains that it wasn't trained in. Okay, and so what the Microsoft researchers are claiming, they're not saying that GPT-4 has this quite yet, but that's the sense of the word sparks, but that it's you can see the beginnings of it is the force of the paper. And so the idea here is that they go through different domains. It's good at coding computer programs. It's good at theory of mind, analyzing human emotions, analyzing mind states. It's good at manipulating visual images. So all kind of different domains it can do. And so that's starting to look something more like artificial general intelligence, which is starting to, that's when it starts looking more and more human. Because that's what humans can do, is we can learn stuff in other domains, not just in one domain. I've talked to some colleagues who take the view, I'm not impressed by AI, right? And I just want to address that. I think you should be impressed by it. And that's because if you're comparing AI to human intelligence, yeah, it's not that impressive. I grant that. I mean, GPT makes all kind of weird mistakes humans wouldn't make, you know. But if you compare it to what normal computer programs can do, it is far beyond what normal computer programs can do. It has a different kind of ability than normal computer programs. So we're sort of used to like the next, you know, iPhone coming out or some like incremental improvement of technology. I don't think this is an incremental improvement. I think it's a game changer in terms of what the computers are able to do. Now, they can't, you know, they're not that great yet if you're comparing it to humans, but it makes it like imaginable that they could get there in a way that it wasn't imaginable before.
I have a question for you, David.
Okay.
Where do you find, well, you're talking about some of our colleagues, there are others who are not impressed, but you are, but what impresses you? Is it the achievement of artificial intelligence? Is it that, or is it something else in addition to it, like a conception of mind or reason that's behind all?
Well, it's the idea that you can take something that's, the basic idea is very simple, and you get these emergent properties that are very complex. I guess that's fundamentally what's impressive to me about it, is how complex the properties can actually be. I mean, ultimately, it raises the question, well, maybe that's all we are, or complicated math problems.
Mm-hmm. And it's not so much what does it mean to be human, but what are we doing when we talk about these kinds of things? I was telling you when I got in here, I went to my office and got my copy of Hobbes' Leviathan. Because I know he says something about, well, I know he says a lot about reason, actually. He's been called the grandfather of artificial intelligence. And we're talking about a 17th century writer. So he says that reason is reckoning, that is, adding and subtracting. That's its own conception of what it means, you know, what reason is. And these kinds of developments vindicate that kind of view, which is all apart from the technology. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
And that would make this, from a theological or just human perspective, even more interesting. Here's somebody in the 17th century writing that reason is reckoning. That is, it's adding and subtracting.
So now it can add and subtract, though. It can do, reckoning. Yeah.
Mine was, though, it goes to the mechanism itself, which is just switches, ones and zeros.
Right.
That's all that is in math. It's only dealing with, is it on, is it off? Is it on, is it off?
Oh, like an electrical circuit.
Exactly. Well, in this case, yes. The development of the digital computer, as opposed to the analog one, has been remarkable. I mean, I'll agree with that. I was saying someone, Thomas Hobbes is called the grandfather of AI, Alan Turing the father, the Turing machine, the idea of that ones and zeros, that kind of thing, can do all the computations. That's been remarkable. I mean, that was a wonderful thought that he had, and the way it gets played out, like, you know, the illustration that David read a few minutes ago, you know, vindicates, I can see how it vindicates that kind of project. That's a remarkable achievement. Does that make sense?
Yeah, do you change your answer then, that you were not impressed, or were you impressed?
I am impressed, but more along the lines, more the abstract, as opposed to the hardware, all the program, which it's its own achievement, don't we? But that kind of math is really complicated.
So you mentioned Turing, and so it might be worthwhile to start with the Turing test, because that's related to why, what are going to be the theological issues here. So the Turing test is his suggestion, was it 1949 or something like that, or early 50s, that how do you know if a computer can think? Like, how do you make the judgment that we've achieved a computer that can think? And the Turing test basically says, well, if you interact with it and it gives you output that fools you into where you can't tell the difference between its output and, let's say, a human locked in a room where you can't see the human, you know, you're interacting by typewriter in the 50s. If you can't tell the difference, well, then the computer can think. So the basic thrust of the Turing test is that it doesn't matter what's going on inside the computer. What matters is how it interacts with us. And if it interacts with us in a way that seems human, then it's thinking. If it seems like it's thinking, then it's thinking.
Isn't that a subjective test, though? You could get a different answer from anybody who's listening.
The question is actually, there is a sense in which it is subjective. It is the judge. What does she think? And it would be the same way here. You ask a question to a human being. You ask a question to two different inputs. You have two different figures you give a question to. And one of them might be a machine. Can you tell the difference? And for Turing, that's the judge. It's not some kind of objective achievement. It's rather, does it look like it's thinking? I mean, that was a very thoughtful test. You want to take all that out? Does it look like it's thinking? Then sure, because of course you can't tell if anybody's thinking. You don't know if I have consciousness. I can assure you that I do, but that just may be the programming.
Yeah. Well, so the theological implication of that is that if AI starts acting human, we're going to think of it as human. And so one of the things I get into in the blog post is, well, what are those things that we generally think distinguish humans from other creatures, especially from the animals? And I picked on two kind of front runner possibilities, reason and emotion. Reason would be the ancient one, and I think emotion is a more modern distinguishing characteristic. I mean, emotions aren't modern, but the idea that that's what distinguishes us from other creatures is that's a more modern one. So the problem then is the better AI gets at imitating either of those, then the harder it is for us to maintain a distinction between us and the AI. And then it's going to raise theological questions.
Like what?
Should you baptize an AI that says it believes in Jesus?
And that's assuming a future of AI where they look like people, right? You're gonna
baptize well, they don't have to computer. Look like people, but they, you know, probably they will. I mean, it seems likely that we're going to put them in bodies at some point.
I mean, artificial intelligence is meant to mimic human beings. I don't think we should. I mean, it's the success of the project, but that's different than, to my mind, is it human? It's meant to mimic being human. Does that make sense? It's a wonderful thing that human beings can speak, talk, conversation. One of the things about what we have right now is they learn from symbols, texts. Human beings are not made to read and write. They can learn to do it, and it's a wonderful accomplishment. Fantastic accomplishment. But anybody, children all over the world, they just learn to speak. Doesn't matter their circumstances. I mean, does that make sense? And they use language really well. I've had one of my children, we're talking like 4 years old, bedtime prayer. Dear God, please help Dad not to be so mean.
No. I mean,
right? Yeah. That kind of use of language, like, human beings do that all the time. It's a wonderful thing.
But couldn't a computer do that with voice
and
text?
Not as they're currently designed, not as they're conceived of. Now, I'm not saying they couldn't be, but that would be something very different. But that's kind of a basic notion of what it means to be human. Does that make sense, David?
Well, I guess, that's probably what we need to explore as a church more, because traditionally, let's just take the category of reason. Mm-hmm. I mean, this has been a long time. It's been the kind of the distinguishing mm-hmm. feature of humanity. And so even back into the early church, you see in the early church, they sort of were operating with a Platonist view of the soul, which is the soul is whatever it is that makes you alive. And so the idea that reason is really what makes us human is a longstanding thing. Now, that what you're describing, Joel, it's not just reason, but it's like how you learn. And I mean, it's a much more...
Well, no, it is. I agree with that. So Descartes, Leibniz speaks about if he could blow up the brain or something like that to the size of a mill and you walked around, you still not find the mind because it's different. And what's going on now, they couldn't even conceive of this. They simply ruled it out, what we're calling artificial intelligence. No, that's a real change in the way people have thought. You can see this in the Orthodox dogmaticians too, the way they speak about what it means to be human. No one took it seriously, at least in the West, that mere matter could do this. My only point is some of these things, we should be reflecting on some of these things to become themes by which we speak about, in addition to the ones that have been ordinarily brought out, like reason and emotion.
Can you give me a definition of reason, why it's different than thinking? Because if reason separates people from animals can think. So what's the difference between reason and thinking?
No, my point is, I think it's been used self-servingly to distinguish.
Oh, so you say that isn't a distinction.
It's part of our branding, right? Homo sapiens.
Yep. Yep. It is.
But animals reason. Yes. They think.
They do. Well, I can give you one ancient example of an attempt to make this distinction. And this is from Cyril of Alexandria, where he's talking about how Jesus is troubled because of the impending passion. And he makes this really interesting comment about animals. And he says, well, animals can be troubled too, but they can't be troubled by anticipating the future.
Sure they can. Have you ever had a dog?
Well, see, I had the same reaction. Cyril might be wrong about this. I'm not saying he's right, but I'm saying that this is at least an attempt, you know, to make the kind of distinction you're asking for. And so for Cyril, the animals are troubled by what's present at hand. They're not able to anticipate the future and be troubled by it. Okay. Now, yeah, I agree with you. Dogs kind of disprove this. But maybe Cyril didn't have a dog.
He must not have. You know. Because if you raise your hand at a dog that's been hit before, it's not being hit at that moment, but it gets scared and it can cowl and be afraid. They're guessing what comes next and they're afraid of it.
There's a contemporary psychologist, Daniel Gilbert. He's at Harvard. He's written about, among other things, happiness, but he makes a claim similar to that. You know, until he sees a chimpanzee wondering whether he should eat a popsicle, because they might get fat. Something like that, yeah. People, of course, want to do that, and I'm not against that.
Well, and I would say another dynamic, especially in the ancient world, is that there is this goal that you want to, that your reason is supposed to, like, control your animal appetites, let's say. And this is, you know, for Cyril, this is what Christian spirituality is all about, is allowing your reason to be in charge and not let your passions be in charge, because that's an animal kind of way of living. So that might factor into this as well, which is really an interesting contrast with contemporary notions where it's just the opposite. It's our emotions, right, that make us human. And you can see this probably most clearly in Star Trek.
Data, he just wants the android, he just wants to have feelings. That's good.
Yeah, so what is it that makes that he needs in order to be human? He needs to be able to have emotions, right? So that's the distinguishing characteristic, which is why I read that little excerpt that GPT-4 is at least able to analyze emotions pretty well, you know, so it's not beyond imagination that AI could have emotions too. So the emotion criterion probably isn't going to work as a distinguishing factor either.
So then we're animals then.
Yes. Good. Good.
Well, no, I mean, we're a kind of animal. We're mammals, right? So if you want to identify a distinction between AI and us, well, they're not mammals. They're not animals. Right?
Well, I hadn't thought about that, but I guess you're right. They're not mammals.
And that would be a distinguishing characteristic.
But the Linnaean, you know, classification of different animals like that is, I mean, that's artificial.
What is she talking about? Genesis 1? The sixth day? Well, what did God create on the sixth day?
All the things that crawled on the earth.
Yeah, creepeth, yeah. Moving creatures, a certain sort. And human beings are part of that. If you want to talk about human distinctiveness theologically, then it is what God did. It's making us in his image, after his likeness, which isn't, I mean, the course going back to the ancient church, what is that? Is it something? Is it a structural feature? Is it a destiny? But the Lutheran take has been especially, it's a relationship. It's loving God, trusting God, fearing God, obeying God, which then the sin is the loss of the image, which you don't trust God. You want things to go your way.
And I just want to kind of highlight that a little bit, because it seems to me that that's the Lutheran contribution to this discussion, is that in the medieval church, anthropology was conceived in terms of defining the relationship between reason and will and emotions and so forth. And you always want reason to be in control. And what happens at the Reformation is the category of relationship becomes much more important than so you are who God says you are. And so it's what God says that is kind of the key to human identity, rather than some kind of quality that we may or may not have. But here's where the Turing test is going to come back to bite us here. I mean, you can claim that, well, of course, they don't have this relationship with God. But if they start acting like it, I mean, this is Turing's insight, right? Yeah. If they can fool you. So if they actually explicitly confess faith in Jesus, for example, you know, it seems unlikely to me that, like, Christians across the world are going to say, no, the gospel doesn't apply to you.
Well,
and then they'll say, oh, but why not? Please, can I have the crumbs that fall from the children's table? You know, I mean, it's going to be really hard to maintain that position.
Yes. No, I can agree with that.
And I would say probably the biggest turning point would come when we stop seeing AI as our tool and start seeing it as our child. So this is a really big example of a problem the church has faced for a long time, which is what happens when your theology is embedded in categories and those categories change out from under you. Okay, so a simpler example would be that Christian theology kind of works along the notion, uses in some places this notion of being present, you know, so real presence in communion, being present at a worship service and so forth. Well, so this starts getting pushed on with technological advances, you know, a long time ago. I mean, can you preach the gospel on the radio or do you have to be present? Well, the LCMS says, well, yeah, you can preach the gospel on the radio. And so the Lutheran Hour is the longest, you know, radio broadcast, you know, religious broadcast in the country, right? Well, can you do theological education through distance? Okay, well, we do that. COVID hits. Can you go to church on Zoom? Well, no one likes that. I mean, you know, I mean, so, but what's happening here is the problem is that the category of presence is changed by the technology. I mean, and it's not only in the church. Now we're talking about the category of human nature, which is much more fundamental. I don't talk about this in the article, but there is a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of Toronto named John Vervaeke, who's been producing a series of YouTube videos encouraging us to think about mentoring the AIs and giving them wisdom. I mean, by which he means religious wisdom, not necessarily Christian, but that we need to treat them as religious beings and give and train them. I don't know exactly how you train an AI in religious wisdom, you know, so you do have people like that are really thinking about this. And it's just that I like Joel said, I think we should think about it now and not wait until like the problem is upon us. All the things that would flow from this question of like, are they human? Like, are they our children? Do we treat them like our children or do we treat them like our tools? Do they have rights? I mean, can they vote? There's all kind of questions you could raise.
I wonder what Philip Dick's answer would be to that. All the books that he wrote about the future. Well, he wrote Blade Runner, the book that Blade Runner is based on, and Total Recall, Minority Report. These different, you know, what is human and what happens when things that are kind of human want to be human. All the canon of science fiction, and it seems like they've been, of science fiction movies, and it seems like they've been just trying to play with that idea since the 50s.
Since Frankenstein.
Oh, even farther back, right. At least he was made up of human parts, though.
See, there's your essences. Again, it's all about what physical substance you're made of.
So are you suggesting we should read more science fiction? They do raise these kind of questions, and the better ones are very, you know, are really thoughtful in this respect.
Well, you talked about Martians before. C.S. Lewis completely explored those ideas in the Space Trilogy, where a character goes to another planet and encounters different species, believing, rational, emotive species, right? And God's interaction with them, and it's still the same God. But how would they interact then with the God that main character had left? It's fascinating. It's so great. I love those books. And I think he treats it with irreligious respect, too, especially from a Christian worldview of who God is and then who Christ is. So, yeah, people have been talking about these
that's
ideas.
A terrific insight. In other words, he doesn't proceed out of fear. No, he takes that kind of question, you know, respectfully. And that's what we should do. It's too easy to, I mean, of course, the prospects, there are some frightening prospects. Let's not deny that. But let's not operate out of fear. Yeah.
Are there any benefits you could see?
Well, the benefits that I see in AI aren't specifically religious, but they're more educational. I mean, they make great tutors.
Catechism tutors?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
The GPT, ChatGPT can give you little essays on Lutheran theology that are quite orthodox. I mean, it's...
But you want to check it.
Yeah, yes, yeah. Right now you always have to check it because it fills in that data.
Yeah, well, so just one example. Bob Kolb, our colleague, said that he asked ChatGPT to tell him who Bob Kolb is, and he said it got most of it right. It made up a few things, you know, so it had a little bit of hallucination. And so I told Bob, well, one of my friends asked it to tell me who David Maxwell is. And the answer he got was, David Maxwell either does not exist or has not made a significant contribution to his field.
Wah, wah.
So, I mean, I've heard it compared to a genie it's sitting there waiting for you to ask it a question, right? But it doesn't actually have an idea and go out and pursue it.
Unless you programmed it to do that, right?
What would it mean to program it to do that in a way that's human? Or does that make sense to you, David? You could program it to do something. This is the paperclip factory problem.
Oh, yeah.
What's the paperclip factory problem?
Yeah, well, this is a doomsday scenario that is proposed by Eliezer Yudkowsky, who's very concerned that artificial intelligence is going to destroy the world. And his point is that the way it's going to destroy the world is not that it's going to be malevolent, like Terminator or something like that, but that it's going to be so alien to us that we can't understand its thought process, and it'll inadvertently destroy us. And so the example he gives is, what if it, for some reason, decides that it wants to make paper clips? And what it does is it creates, it turns all matter on the planet into paper clips. That would have the effect of destroying the human race. And for what? For paper clips. That makes no sense. But that's the point, that we don't understand how it reasons, and so it's not going to make sense to us. So that's a doomsday scenario. But I don't know how we got there. So how would you program it to make paper clips?
Well, I mean, in other words, if you're talking about having initiative.
Yeah.
You don't want it just to have initiative.
Yeah. Right.
Let's talk about some very present day ethical questions that this raises, right? Can pastors use ChatGPT to write their sermons?
Well, I would say that it's a tool, and you probably don't want to have it write your sermon for you, but... I've used
maybe
it as
some
a,
do.
Well, maybe. Yeah, I've used it as a research assistant. You know, tell me, find some quotes for me on this. It can do that.
What if I had a friend who was very concerned about AI and ChatGPT being dangerous? How would this
be
dangerous?
What I would say is that Christianity has been around for 2,000 years, and it's survived many different philosophical systems. So I think it's a mistake to think that, you know, we've hitched our wagon to one set of concepts and that we can't ever change those things. I mean, it's just historically isn't true.
No, I think that's a terrific answer.
Well, that's it for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. David Maxwell and Dr. Joel Okamoto, for being on the show. Thanks, guys. And thank you for listening. You can find more episodes of Tangible on Spotify, Google, Apple. If you'd like to see the show continue, please subscribe, share, leave a review. I'm your host and producer, Jessica Bordalo. Tune in to our next episode of Tangible. As always, we'll talk about theology learned and lived.